Now, here is our chief Washington correspondent, Eric Severide, on the war or peace climate as it looks from his observatory on the Potomac.
Well, Ed, last June 26th, this reporter was solemnly advising his listeners that the United States probably would not come to the aid of the South Koreans, the very hour of night when the president was radioing MacArthur to do so. And ever since then, I've taken the high moral position that reporters should not predict anything in world affairs. All I can do is report the facts and the judgments of authorities here who have to make predictions and act upon them. Among these men, there is no fear that we can be defeated in Korea this spring, though they think the enemy may have a temporary advantage during the period of thaw and mud. There is some fear of a big-scale Chinese invasion of Indochina. But there is less and less fear of war in Europe this spring or summer. If the East were planning to invade the West, there would be unconcealable signs of preparation now, and there are no such signs. American ambassadors and ministers from all over Europe have just finished a series of conferences, and they all agreed that the farther one travels east, the calmer things are. They agreed that in Russia's satellite nations, there are no signs of approaching military moves. Hungary is the only one building air raid shelters, for example, and she appears to be doing that only as part of her general preparedness program, in which she is behind her neighbors. All these countries, the American experts agreed, are having a desperately hard time to reconstruct their armies and are badly short of qualified officers. Nowhere, however close to Russia, are the families or the staffs in American embassies becoming nervous or asking to go home. And perhaps the most impressive suggestion of peace for this spring and summer is the fact that Tito of Yugoslavia isn't even asking for American arms, though he badly needs arms. He wants economic help. He wants to produce his own arms later on. He thinks there's time. And if the man sitting on the number one bullseye feels relaxed about the next few months, that seems to Washington authorities a pretty fair argument for a peaceful prospect.
As you have heard, there is a mild wind of optimism in many of the world's capitals, including our own. It's been building up for the past 2 months, this feeling that spring will not mean war, except in Korea. The reasons for this change in the climate of opinion are not quite clear. The balance of power has not altered substantially in 2 months. The West remains on the defensive. We might do well to remember the estimate of the situation given by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Omar Bradley. In that job, you can't afford to have your judgment influenced by the warming winds of spring. And General Bradley said, despite the peace talk going around, we are in just as much of an emergency now as we were 6 months ago. We must not be lulled into any false sense of security.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for ear based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Are you listening to me with both of your very own ears? Listen.
Skippy peanut butter stays fresh, sweet, and easy to spread to the last spoonful.
Did you hear me?
Then what's holding you back? Get Skippy peanut butter.
This is the WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.
This is Program 12 on Hear It Now, a full-hour review of the week's news told in the actual recorded voices of the men and women who make the news. Once again, here is the editor of Hear It Now, Edward R. Murrow.
18 months ago, the United Nations General Assembly listened to a spokesman for Czechoslovakia define the communist view on human rights. He was Vladimir Klementis, then foreign minister of the Czech government. This week, Vladimir Klementis was another victim of charges by his own communist party that he had confessed to treason, that he engaged in a conspiracy to overthrow his government. Klementis is under arrest. The free world has not heard a word from him. But listen to Vladimir Klementis speak on treason and punishment.
Legal punishment of high treason and other crimes according to penal law cannot be considered as a violation of human rights.
Vladimir Klementis with this view. Legal punishment of high treason and other crimes cannot be considered as a violation of human rights. He maintained that the Soviet and her satellites never violated human rights. We do not know his views today, 18 months later, in a Czechoslovak prison, accused of high treason. On a hot day in August 1940, Wendell Willkie stood in the sun of Rushville, Indiana, and challenged the third-term bid of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
And I would also like to debate the question of the assumption by this president in seeking a third term of a greater public confidence than was accorded to our presidential giants, Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson.
In all U.S. history, only one man has been elected for a third term and a fourth. On Tuesday of this week, it became the law of the land that no president could seek a third term.
Proceed with the regular order of business. House Joint Resolution number 17, relative to the amendment of the Constitution of the United States, limiting the term of president to two terms.
The Senator from Monroe, Senator Barnes, moves the House concur in the resolution. Are you ready for the question?
The voices you heard came from Nashville, Tennessee, which last week became the 34th state to ratify the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution.
Those opposed vote no.
Ackland. Blackville. Vote.
When Tennessee passed it last week, only two more were needed. On Monday, Utah became the 35th state. And later on Monday, the state of Nevada voted. The state of Nevada, the 36th state admitted to the Union, became the 36th state to ratify the 22nd Amendment.
Senator Lovelock, Senator Monk.
Like it or not, the fourth term victory of FDR would stand as an all-time record, ensured by those who fought him most. The halls of the United Nations were empty this week, as the peacemakers hoped that a Ridgeway victory might improve their bargaining position. The Good Offices Committee requested that the press not embarrass its work with too much publicity. And another special United Nations committee, studying the literacy of the nations of the world, came up with some rather surprising statistics on the newspaper habits of the American people. Here is Scotsman Patrick Loftus of the UN reporting on which people read the most daily newspapers.
You know that Francis Bacon once said that reading maketh a full man. In that sense, the American man, although a leader in so many fields, is less advanced than many European men, if we are to judge by the United Nations Statistical Yearbook. He is sixth in the scale of development as judged by the reading of daily newspapers. The leading country in this respect is the United Kingdom, where there are 60 copies of daily newspapers to every 100 persons, man, woman, and child. Next come Australia and Luxembourg, with 43 and 44 copies to every 100 people. Then Norway and Sweden with 42, and the United States with 35 copies. The smallest circulations are found in Eastern Asia. For example, China has only one newspaper for every 100 persons, whereas Afghanistan has only one for every 1,000 persons. The American can console himself, however, with the thought that if he's not reading, he is doing something else. For example, in England, most people travel to work by train and bus, and they therefore purchase both a morning and an evening paper to read on the way. The majority of Americans can't do this because they drive to work. It may sound curious, but we can say that more newspapers will be sold if the shortage of motor cars becomes acute.
Whether you read six newspapers a day, as some Americans do, or none, or learned about the day's happenings from the radio or television, it was apparent to all that happy harmony did not exist between organized labor and the defense setup. Earlier, Republican Senator Aiken of Vermont had accused big business of running the mobilization show.
There's no question about it. Big business in this administration is more in the saddle than it has been in a generation. On the other hand, agriculture and labor have been pretty much left out of top-level representation up to this time.
And William Green, president of the AFL, accused mobilizer Wilson of freezing wages, but not really freezing prices, and he threatened action.
Unfortunately, there is overwhelming evidence that the defense program is being dominated by the philosophy of big business. As a result, the public is getting price control in name only, as against wage freezing in fact. That is why the United Labor Policy Committee is calling for a showdown now.
On Wednesday, the Policy Committee of the United Labor Movement, representing the AFL, the CIO, and the railway unions, voted to walk out of the wage stabilization setup. George Meany, Secretary Treasurer of the AFL, spoke for labor.
The plain people of this country are being made the victims of a so-called stabilization policy dictated by the big business executives who are running the defense mobilization program. There is no one in the defense setup to protect the interests of the millions of Americans who work for wages and salaries. Labor tried to get a voice in the determination of policy, but our representatives were being used merely as window dressing, so they walked out in protest.
We asked Eric Johnson, the Economic Stabilization Director, to comment on labor's charges. He said he wanted to think it over. Mobilization Director Charles Wilson was to have issued a statement today, but canceled it. Apparently, administration leaders have decided to keep silent for the time being, hoping that labor opposition will abate. Before the president left for Key West on his vacation, he said he didn't think the whole thing was too serious, said he had complete confidence in Charles Wilson and Mike DeSalle. But labor has not been so united on anything in a long time, and the bitterness runs deep. Finding a formula to end this domestic argument won't be easy. John Foster Dulles came home from a visit to the Pacific this week. He had tried to find a formula for a peace treaty with Japan. He thinks it can be done this year, and that Russia can be contained in the Pacific. Here is part of Mr. Dulles' report.
We should never forget that Stalin long ago laid it down as basic communist strategy, that the road to victory over the West, as he put it, lies through the East. That is still taught in the Communist Bible. Militant communism has never abandoned its Far Eastern strategy. As it stands today, Japan, Korea, Okinawa, Formosa, the Philippines, Australia, New Zealand, and Southeast Asia are what stand between the United States and the vast manpower and natural resources of Northeast Asia, which are already being exploited by the new Russian imperialism. If Japan should succumb to communist aggression, there would then be a combination of Russian, Japanese, and Chinese power in the East that would be dangerously formidable. It is the unqualified judgment of General MacArthur that the Japanese people have won the right to be restored to a position of equality within the Society of Free Nations. And our mission wholly endorses that conclusion.
One word dominates much of the news and conversation in this country. Eric Johnston put it this way.
Inflation is one of the greatest threats that we face in the United States. I think it is just as great a threat as Russia, because I think Russia could lick us if we weaken ourselves by inflation.
The common enemy is inflation. Who is leading our fight against high prices? His name is Michael DeSalle. But what do we know about him? General Eisenhower is the man designated by the president to fight communism in Europe for us. And we know almost everything about the general, except his politics. But what do we know about Mike DeSalle, director of the Office of Price Stabilization? We wondered what the average citizen thought about him and the job he's doing. Our reporters in Louisville and Boston went out on the street, asked the first five passers-by if they knew who Michael DeSalle was. On Tremont Street in Boston, we asked, who is Mike DeSalle?
I really don't know.
Never heard of him.
I don't know. Does he sell cars?
Oh, let me see. He discovered the Fountain of Youth, didn't he?
Ain't he some fat fella down in Washington?
Then from Louisville.
Can you tell me, who is Michael DeSalle?
No, sir.
He's the price administrator.
Well, that I wouldn't know.
Price administrator, I believe.
I don't believe I know the gentleman or the lady, whichever the sex may be.
The box score of our very unscientific poll. In Boston, no identification out of five. In Louisville, two identifications out of five. For the past few days, we've been shadowing Mr. DeSalle, with his permission, with a microphone and recorder. For the remaining minutes of this program, we shall attempt to do a brief self-portrait for ear of Mike DeSalle. He didn't pose for us. We had to catch him on the run.
I don't take myself seriously because price stabilizers are always expendable. You can't help but come out of this job all scratched up and bleeding.
Mike DeSalle weighs 215 pounds and stands 5 feet 5.